Yesterday, Mike and I went fishing and we listened to some prophecy things, and I heard the statistics of how many in America have a Christian worldview, and how many of those who call themselves Christians really have a Christian worldview, and it's depressing. And then I heard some other news, and it was kind of depressing. And then this morning I checked the news before I went over the message, and it's depressing. It's depressing. But then I went over my message, and it's encouraging. See, we have it here. You read it there. This morning, the resurrection. And it is encouraging. So on Passover day, I spoke on Romans 4:25. It says that Christ was delivered up because of our offenses and was raised up because of our justification. It is his resurrection that gives us victory in life. His death procured our justification. His resurrection gives us overcoming power to live the victorious Christian life. On Resurrection Sunday, in my earlier ministry from 1995 to 2004, I covered 10 messages on various topics regarding Christ's resurrection. And then I began to go through 1 Corinthians 15, which is the resurrection chapter of the Bible. And I've done 6 messages, and we are now at 1 Corinthians 15:32. We covered in the last messages the very difficult subject of the baptism for the dead. We've heard the Mormons mentioned here already. This is a very high verse for the Mormons. And at that time, I thought I was going to hand things over to someone else, but I take it like some others. I have been not retired, but retreaded. And so I am back at 1 Corinthians 15. As I outline 1 Corinthians 15, we have 4 big points. First, in verses 1 through 11, we have the importance of the resurrection declared. Then in verses 12 through 19, we have the denial of the resurrection. Third, in 20 through 34, we have the hope of the resurrection restated. And fourth, in 35 through 50, we have the manner of the resurrection questioned. How will it happen? In our last message quite some time ago, we had almost covered the third point I just mentioned, where the hope of the resurrection was restated. That third point covered from verses 20 through 34. In verses 20 through 28, we have the future with the hope of this resurrection. 29 through 34, we have the futility of life without this hope. And 33 through 34, we have the foiling of this hope. And we were up to 33 through 34, which complete point 3. And I didn't quite have time to finish that. We'll just briefly look at those verses this morning. Verses 33 through 34 say, "Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. Awake to righteousness. Do not sin, for some do not have the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame." Verse 33 says, "Do not be deceived." Here is a warning to those who are questioning the resurrection because they have some present who are denying the resurrection. When quite a number of people begin saying the same thing, we begin to question what we have believed. Isn't that interesting? So Paul, according to John Calvin, then quotes one of their own poets from Athens, which is the main city close to where the Corinthians lived. And this is what Meander, the poet, said. "Evil company corrupts good habits." You know, who you hang out with is what you're going to become like. Well, we know this. We've all watched enough young people. It's true of us older people too, you know. If you hang around those whose teaching differs from yours, sooner or later it will affect you. And in verse 34, Paul then says to those who were questioning the resurrection, "Awake to righteousness and do not sin, for some do not have the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame." Albert Barnes says the word here translated "awake" denotes properly to awake up from a deep sleep or torpor, and is usually applied to those who awake or become sober after having been drunk. John Gill agrees with that. The Corinthians had become so enamored with the teaching that there was no resurrection that Paul likens it to being overtaken with drunkenness. And he says, sober up. Time to sober up. And then he says, and do not sin. And if they would depart from the doctrine of the resurrection, it would be a sin. So it is time to sober up. Then Paul says, for some do not have the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. Those who did not have this knowledge of the resurrection were within the church. By the way, the church today in many, many places is leaving the path. We have friends who are on some of those paths. Do we have the courage to speak up? And those to whom Paul had taught this doctrine should have taught those who were denying the resurrection, not the other way around. To embrace the teaching of the deniers was the foiling of the hope of the resurrection, and that would be to the shame of those who had been taught better. That brings us now to our next point, the manner of the resurrection question. So look at verse 35, which gives us the question that Paul will seek to answer in the following verses. It says, but someone will say, how are the dead raised up, and with what body do they come? And in verses 36 through 41, those questions are answered. So we go then to the first of the two questions raised in verse 35. How are the dead raised up? I don't doubt you've thought of that. You've wondered about that. Take people who have been buried in a grave and their body is decomposed. Or take people who have been cremated and the ashes of their bodies are spread out all over the place. Or take Harry Truman, who lived up on Mount St. Helens, and he said, this mountain doesn't dare blow up on me, and it blew up on him. And then that fast, he was gone in ashes up in the air somewhere. What about Harry Truman? You know what? He's going to be resurrected. He'll be raised up. And so the question is, how are the dead raised up? The second question, still in verse 35, okay, let's say there is a resurrection. With what body do they come? This body has decomposed or was cremated or it went up in a cloud of ash or the great white shark digested it. So with what body do they come? First of all, how can the dead be raised? But if they are raised, with what body do they come? Those then are the two questions before us. And this is resurrection morning. This is the Feast of First Fruits, by the way. It is a lot easier to ask questions than to answer them. But that is what Paul sets out to do in the next verses. In verses 36 through 38, he answers the first question, how are the dead raised? He begins like this, foolish one. He is addressing the one who is questioning the resurrection and calls him a foolish one. An unwise one, or one without reason, or a senseless one. Why would Paul call them something like that? Well, I think the questioner here might well have been ridiculing the possibility of a resurrection. He's saying, bah, a resurrection? That's ridiculous. How could decomposed people be resurrected? And Paul says, foolish one, senseless one. Now think of how foolish such a person is. If you believe God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and you find the resurrection an impossibility, is that not a foolish one? And furthermore, Paul had preached the gospel to them in this chapter in verses 1 through 6. He told them about Christ's death, his resurrection. And then he told them that this all happened according to the scriptures. And the apostle Peter had seen Christ alive. Paul said that. The disciples all saw him alive. And after that, he said at one time, over 500 people saw him alive. And he said, the most of those are still alive. You can still check it out with them. And last, Paul says, I saw him alive myself. And after Paul told them this, they began to come to church. And now they were saying there was no resurrection. Why would you go to church? How can the dead be made alive? That was their question. The whole gospel hangs on the fact of the resurrection. No resurrection, no gospel, and no use to come to church, and no use believing God created the heavens and the earth. And if the apostles, even Paul himself and over 500 people at another time had seen Christ alive, what is the difference how it happened? The question is, did it happen? And it did. Now, I don't think asking legitimate questions is a problem here. It is asking in such a way as thinking this to be silly. So Paul says, foolish ones. We go to verse 36. Foolish one, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. Now Paul says, what you sow. Paul will use the analogy of planting seeds. Seeds are what you sow or plant. And if you have a seed and you don't plant it, it will never spring up into life. That is the principle of the seed. So to bring forth life, the seed must die. Jesus said, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abides alone. But if it falls into the ground and dies, it brings forth much fruit. So seeds in themselves teach the principle, life comes out of death. So why marvel that the body could be resurrected? So we too must die. Who wants to live forever in this body? I don't think. The older you get, the less you want to spend the rest of your time in a body like this. There's only one way to a better life than the one we have here. It is by death, or by changing this body, as this chapter will later show. It says we will not all die, but we will all be changed. This body must go in order to attain a new body. So Paul says, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. There is no other way. We can learn that from the principle of the seed. So Paul goes on like this in verse 37. And what you sow, you do not sow that body that shall be, but mere grain, perhaps wheat or some other grain. I wonder how many of you have puzzled about this verse. Anybody here? Have you pondered the verse? I have for many years. This is the first time I've ever given a lot of time to studying it. When you put a seed in the ground, it is not that seed that grows up. That seed has to die. What grows up comes out of that seed. Take a grain of wheat. It is not the seed that comes out of the ground and grows. It is a blade, then another, then a stem, and so on. But the seed itself, it dies. Now the passage sounds like you could put one kind of seed in the ground and perhaps any other kind of grain might grow up. This is what I've pondered over the years. If you're using the King James Version, it says, it may chance of wheat or of some other grain. It sounds like you plant the body, but something entirely different may come up. But that is not true of the law of sowing and reaping, nor is that what he is saying. The principle of sowing and reaping is that you reap what you sow. That is, you reap the same kind as the seed you sow. I would interpret this verse like this. Perhaps you sow wheat or barley or anything else. When it grows up, it will be exactly the same kind of plant as the seed was, but it won't be the same seed. That seed has to die. So when we die, it will not be the same body that is resurrected, nor do we want the same body back. Or anybody here want the same body back? The older you get, the less you'll want it back. I can assure you of that. Just like a plant that grows is not the same seed that was sown, but it is that which grew out of the seed that was sown. So when we are resurrected, it will not be this very same body, but like a seed brings forth after its kind, so this body will bring forth after its kind. And there are many ways in which the resurrection body will be like this one, though it is not the same one. We have not time here, but if we looked at Christ's resurrection or at his resurrected bodies, we would see a lot of similarities and then differences. And the differences are huge. So this is Paul's answer to the question, how are the dead raised? Like a seed that is sown in the ground and dies and rots away, yet it brings a new plant that is the same kind the seed was, yet different. This is the principle on which bodies are raised. Now, it might be debated where Paul begins to answer the second question, which is, and with what body do they come? I view it as starting in verse 38. Others see it as starting in verse 39. Verse 38 says this, but God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body. I wonder how many of you, if you look at your bodies, would like some improvements on the next one. Paul continues now with the illustration of the seed. Paul says that God gives each seed a body as it pleases him. Anybody know how many people in the world today? 7 billion. What I read was 7.6 billion are alive today. And I understand that if science is right, no two people have ever been identical. As a matter of fact, there's all kinds in our bodies that has never been identical to anybody else. Scientists say no two snowflakes have ever been identical. Well, I'm not sure they all watch them all, but I guess you can check some of this and say that. And in the resurrection, no two bodies will ever be identical. Why? Because God gives each one a body as he pleases. Notice, he gives to each individual seed its own body. So it will be in the resurrection. Many years ago, I read this from John MacArthur. He says, I have read that there are some 600 octodecillion different combinations of amino acids. An octodecillion is 10 to the 108th power, or 1 followed by 108 zeros. Now, you have no idea what that means. I don't either. It's big. Amino acids, he says, are the building blocks of all life. Not only does each type of plant and animal have a distinct pattern of amino acids, but each individual plant, animal, and human being has its own unique grouping of them. I just saw a guy on Fox News had his DNA tested, and they said, you're so many percent this, you're so many percent this, you're so many percent this. I'm still quoting now. No two flowers, snowflakes, seeds, blades of grass, or human beings, even identical twins, are exactly alike. Yet each is completely identified with its own species or kind. Now notice that in the resurrection, God gives to each person a body as it pleases him. That body is not the same body as the one that was put in the grave. Praise the Lord. It is a different body, but it is of the very same kind. We see that in the resurrection of Christ. Now, let me tell you what I think will please God. I'm convinced of it. It will please him to give to everybody, to each one, according to what he has been here in life. I'm convinced of it. That's the kind of body you're going to have. The kind of wedding dress you'll have too, you know. Revelation 19. So every seed of the octodecillion seeds gets a different body by God. So everybody who dies, an overcoming Christian, will get his or her own unique body. And Paul is saying, and you want to know with what body they come? We come then to verse 39. Paul says, all flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, another of birds. So Paul is saying, I think, you want to know with what body they come? Just like all flesh is not the same flesh, so in the resurrection, not everybody will have the same body. They are all different. I understand that the Catholics could not eat meat on Friday. That's why they ate fish on Friday, because fish wasn't classed as a meat. But Paul says that fish are another kind of meat, but it is different from birds or beasts. What are we to learn from this? As all kinds of flesh are basically composed the same, yet there are different kinds of flesh, so in heaven, though all resurrected beings will be basically composed the same, yet they will all differ one from another. As every wheat seed is different, can you believe this, that every wheat seed, there have never been two the same? But once you start to ponder the parts, you can see why that has to be. So as every wheat seed is different, though it is all wheat, so every Christian who is resurrected will be different, though they are all Christians. Every single one will be uniquely different from the other. It is so with grass. It is so with trees. It is so with fish. It is so with birds. And it is so with all living beings, even some non-animate, or maybe most of them. As there are numerous different kinds of flesh on earth, so everybody in heaven will have a different kind of body. As every seed produces after its kind and is basically constituted the same, yet every seed has a different body, so it will be in the resurrection. We go to verse 40. It says, there are also celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies, but the glory of the celestial is one and the glory of the terrestrial is another. Paul is seeking to answer the question, with what body the resurrected come? And he says, I have shown you this from different kinds of seeds, from different kinds of flesh. Now let me show you this another way. There are heavenly bodies and there are earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is one, and the glory of the earthly is another. Well, what are these heavenly bodies? Well, they are stars and planets beyond earth. Now, you know how different from the sun the moon is, or how different the moon is from Mars. Take the earthly bodies. Take fish. What an amazing assortment of fish, but they're all fish. When my siblings and I were young, during the long winter days, sometime by gas lantern and evenings, we would sometimes draw and color things. And one of the things I remember is Dr. Seuss's book with all various kinds of fish. Anybody seen this book? All different colors, Dr. Seuss. And we would trace them and color them. But you know, Dr. Seuss had no idea what there all was. Today we still don't know what's all there, but there's a lot more than we knew then. So today, with modern science, the variety of fish has multiplied itself many times, at least that we know about. But that is only the fish. The subject is so very vast. There are plants and rocks and reptiles and all kinds of species of animals, so that this subject is staggering. Take the particles of sand. Each has its own unique body. But this is only the terrestrial realm. Let me quote from a message I did many years ago when I preached on Genesis, on creation, and I quote, so we're looking at the creation of the lights. It tells us in this verse that God made two great lights. These refer to the sun and the moon. Let me ask a little trivia question. Is the sun a planet or a star? It's a star. The sun is a star. I understand a star is a self-gravitating, glowing mass that doesn't move about like the planets do. See, the planets comes from the Greek word planetes. It means they move around. Stars don't do that. The sun is how many miles away? That's a pretty accurate answer. 93 million miles away. How many light minutes is it away? 8. So they tell me. Now, light travels a little more than 11 million miles a minute. Now, they can measure light so precisely now that they once thought they had it down to a science, and they now found out they were out a wee little bit. Now, the heat of the sun is 27 million degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not sure who's been there, but that's what they say. Imagine this morning a fire at Tompkins Landing or at the river that you could feel from Tompkins Landing. So I'm preaching at the church there. How hot would it have to be? How hot? Now imagine a fire at White Horse in the Yukon. How hot would it have to be in order to feel it here? Well, let's say Germany. How hot would it have to be if we could feel it here from Germany? Well, think of, say, 25,000 miles away. How hot would it have to be so you could feel it 25,000 miles away? Think of 100,000 miles. How hot would it have to be? That is still small. How about 1 million miles away? How about 93 million miles away and you can feel it? Imagine the consummation of those wavelengths. Isn't it fantastic? Our sun itself is mind-boggling. Notice again that the description of creation is from a practical point of view, not a scientific point. We often speak in practical terms, not scientific. When we speak of the sunrise, we are not very scientific. We're talking practical. And creation is explained from a practical standpoint of view. Now we are told that God created two great lights. The sun is a relatively small star. Did you know that? It's relatively small. There are stars that are much larger. Dr. Harold Wilmington writes that if the sun were hollow, it could hold 1,300,000 Earths. That's a little hard for our little computer. The star Antares could hold 64 million suns. So the sun is still small. There is a certain star in the cluster of Hercules which could contain 100 million Antares stars. I'm not sure how accurate they are. It's all pretty big. Does anyone know the name of that star? Anybody know the name of that star? Can hold all these Antares? Epsilon. The star Epsilon could hold, they say, 27 billion of our suns. So the sun is not that big in comparison. I do not know how accurate all of those things are, but if they are anywhere near, it is phenomenal. We have a telescope at our house, and you can turn it on the moon and see the craters and the cracks on the moon, and when you turn that telescope on the stars, it hardly makes any difference at all. It makes a big difference on the moon, but it's relatively close, end of quote there. So our text, look at verse 41. There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for one star differs from another in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. You see, there is a glory to the sun. It is a most amazing subject once you begin to study it. But then go out on a crisp, cold night and watch the clouds cover and uncover the moon. Or take a telescope and draw in another planet. The glory of each one is vastly different. So Paul says in verse 42a, so also is the resurrection of the dead. When the question is asked in our text, and with what body do they come? The answer is that these bodies will differ vastly in glory. I personally believe each person will come with a body that will be a manifestation of what they have lived like on earth. Here on earth, women like to be beautiful. Look at young boys. Talk about the pipes. It's in us. They like to be considered muscular and strong and tough. But here on earth, we don't have too much say on the kind of body we have, right? We could doctor it up a little bit. Some paint, huh? I know we can dress the body so that it gives more of the look we would like it to have, but it's pretty limited. But if I am right that what we will be like after the resurrection, it will be determined by how we have lived here. We have everything to do with what we will be like after the resurrection, as I see it. Just like there are octodecillion different kinds of seeds, so there will be all different kinds of bodies. I expect that just as there are different classes of flesh, So there will be different classes of people. I expect that just as the star and planets differ in glory one from another, so the glory of one person will be greater or lesser than the other. But there will be a very big difference in how it is handled. I am fully convinced that those who have the greatest glory or who will be in the best class will be gladly recognized as such by those who have less glory. No jealousy, no envy. Sin will no longer plague those who are there. When they meet someone whose glory far exceeds theirs, they will say, "Oh, you so deserve this. You so deserve this. Oh, I am so glad for you. I rejoice and am privileged to be with you, and I am so glad for what God has chosen for you." I believe that's what we're going to be like. So how are the dead raised? Just like a seed that falls into the ground and dies, but a totally new plant springs to life. With what body do they come? Oh, the subject is so vast. Everybody will be so different one from another. So we've looked at the two questions and then at how Paul answers them. And now we want to look at the realities expressed by Paul in verses 42 through B through 50. We won't cover the whole passage. We can only begin. So we come next to two realities. This is the second point of this section. Let me just introduce the second point. The first section had two questions which were then answered. This next section gives us the two realities. In verses 42 through 44, as I outline this section, we have the facts of these two realities. Paul will now deal with these realities, and here's the first fact regarding the body in 42b. It is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. Second fact, the first part of verse 42. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. The third fact, 43b, it is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. Fourth fact, 44a, it is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. Paul then says, there is a natural body, and there is a spiritual body. These two realities we must be aware of and arrange our life accordingly, or we will go to hell. That simple. Yesterday as we were driving, I was asked, how do you keep from becoming complacent? Could you answer that? Oh, we must be on guard in this life. Then in verse 45, we have the source of these two realities. They are first and the last Adam. We find this in verse 45. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul. The last man, Adam, was made a quickening spirit. Then in verses 46 through 49, we have the order of the two realities. We'll just read these verses for now. Howbeit that was not first which is spiritual, but that which is natural, and afterward that which is spiritual. The first man is of the earth, earthy. The second man is the Lord from heaven. As is the earthy, such are they also that are earthy. And as is the heavenly, such are also they that are heavenly. And so we have borne the image of the earthy. We shall also bear the image of the heavenly. What we have presented us to here then are these two realities. These two realities are the natural and the supernatural, the physical and the spiritual. I don't need to talk to us about the natural realm in such a way as to try to make us understand that there is a natural realm. We are in it, and it is so obvious it needs no explanation to most people. There are some who deny this, you know. I heard of one yesterday, but many years ago I was driving in that long, lonely stretch between Prince George, B.C. and McBride, and I picked up a hitchhiker. I think he said he believed in what is called Christian Science, and he believed that nothing was real. He said, see that road there before us? Oh, I see it. It's not really real. That's not real. Well, we discussed that, and I was quite a new believer. So I asked, I said, I see you're wearing a belt on your knife. Well, what is that for? Oh, he said, imagine not getting picked up in this lonely stretch and having to stay in the bush there, and a bear might come. I said, bear? What do you mean? They're not real. Bears are not real. So when I dropped him off at Jasper, I think it was a bridge just out of Jasper, he stepped out and he said, all guys like you do for me is you make me doubt what I believe. It was about time. But it is much different with regard to the spiritual realm. Now you know what? We have many Christians who don't even believe in Satan, professing Christians. We have all kinds of believers who don't give credibility to demons. You know what Paul said? We wrestle not with flesh and blood. Who is that? Who's we? Christians. If you're not wrestling with demons, you are not a Christian. That simple. We should know that there is a spiritual realm from life and death. Take the body, for instance. Today, scientists can take the body apart down to the parts of the parts of the parts. Right? Way, way down. I asked omniscient Google, how many cells there are in the body? And when I typed in how many cells, it already knew what I was going to ask. So it gave me the whole question. And the first thing that came up was, number of cells in the human body is tricky. Part of the problem is that using different metrics get you different outcomes. Guessing based on volume gets you an estimate of 15 trillion cells. Estimate by weight, you end up with about 70 trillion cells. How many is this? My little calculator doesn't do much on that. Well, needless to say, it is a very large amount. And each of those cells is extremely complex. Now, when a person dies, you can take man apart to the inner cell and everything physical is still there, but the body is dead. What happened? What happened? Something is gone. And James tells us what is gone. He said the body without the spirit is dead. The spirit is gone. And the spirit, of course, is spiritual. There is a spiritual reality. It is very real. Satan is real. Demons are absolutely real. God is a spiritual being, and according to the Bible, angels and demons are spiritual beings, and they are very real. But because they are spiritual, and we can't see them, we can easily deny them. All we can do yet this morning is to begin the facts of these two realities in verse 42. So we begin then with the first fact regarding these two realities. Verse 42b says of the body, it is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption. Paul has used the principle of the seed to answer the questions, how are the dead raised and with what body do they come? He now uses the principle of the seed to show what happens. And what happens is that the body, as a seed, is sown in corruption and it is raised in incorruption. So the two realities we have is the earthly or the natural and the heavenly or the supernatural. And the facts regarding the body as related to these realities are first in 42b, the body is sown in corruption. When we put a body in the ground, it is sown like a seed. And like a seed is lifeless when it is put in the ground, so the body is lifeless when it is put in the ground. So Paul says it is sown in corruption. Nature and its processes will go to work on this seed and begin to destroy the seed. But after it has undergone destruction, it releases what is inside and it springs up into new life. This is how the resurrection is. The body is sown in corruption. It is raised in incorruption. Well, we know what corruption is. A seed that is placed in the ground undergoes this corruption. It If it does not undergo corruption, neither will it bring life. So Jesus said, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and dies, it abides alone. The influences that corrupt must first go to work on the seed before it will spring to life. In the fall of the year in our country, everything can look kind of drab and gray. It feels kind of like death. The trees release their leaves. You know, it's not the wind that blows the leaves off. The trees release them. They let go of them. Then the wind can blow them off. But then in the springtime, when the temperature is right, and the temperature has to be right, nature is going to have to compensate the spring a little bit, right? When the temperature is right, the influences of nature go to work, and new life springs up all over the place, and it is a most enjoyable time of year. I'd just like to see how many of you like springtime. The body will not be raised until the temperature is right. But it's coming. Over the span of 6,000 years, bodies have been planted all over this earth. And Christ was the first fruits of the resurrection. I'm going to go over time a little bit. You know what the resurrection, it talks about the resurrection of the dead. In the Greek, there in many places, it's this idea, the resurrection out from among the dead. The resurrection of Christ was out from among the dead. They stayed in the ground. He arose. When the rapture happens, it will be a resurrection out from the dead. They will stay in the ground, but the Christian will be resurrected. And Christ was the first fruits of the resurrection. Today is the feast day of first fruits, at least as we commemorate it. But after Christ's resurrection, the church will be resurrected. Turn to verses 20 through 24. You're right there. It says, for since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive. But each one in his own order. Christ the first fruits. That's what we have today. Afterward, those who are Christ at his coming. Then comes the end when he delivers up the kingdom to God the Father, when he puts an end to all rule and all authority and power. That's after the millennium. For he must reign till he has put all things under his feet. The last enemy that will be destroyed is death. Jesus Christ was the first fruits of the resurrection. Today we commemorate the Jewish feast of first fruits. This is what it is all about. But the next part of the resurrection will include all those who are his at his coming. Skip down to verses 51 through 52. Here Paul says, behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. When Paul says we, he is speaking of the church age believer. There are those who are Christ's at his coming, and we are considering fact number one in these two realities, the physical and the spiritual. And fact number one is that this corruptible must put on incorruption. And at the rapture, the catching up, the corruptible part of the Christian will take on incorruption. Those who have died will be resurrected, and those who are alive will be changed. Paul then goes on in verse 53 like this, for this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O grave, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through Jesus Christ our Lord. This is what we look forward to. We have this to look forward to, the resurrection. We'll go to a land where we'll never grow old. And we will be raised in incorruption. The laws of thermodynamics will never have power over us again. You see, our feast day today, in closing, is the feast day of first fruits. You know, the older I get, the less I like this word Easter. And so to summarize, we have answered two questions with Paul. How are the dead raised and with what body do they come? They are raised by first experiencing death. Death is not the end. It is required for a new beginning. Just like a seed springs forth in life when it undergoes corruption, so this corruptible must die first. And with what body do they come? Well, that depends on the body the Lord is pleased to give each one. And that will be a body in human form like the one we have now. That it will be this is clear from the resurrection of Christ. It is amazing the amount of importance we place on the body here on earth. What does a woman not go through to be pretty? But, you know, some don't have to go through much. Even us men, we have quite a problem to get things looking halfway decent. But you know what? In glory, God will give everybody a body as it pleases him. What do you think it will be like? Is it worth this life? Is it worth this life? You see, here on earth, some of us don't have much to glory in when it comes to this body, but everything can change on the other side. In heaven, God will give to each one a body as it pleases him. So I know it is a body. Listen, this is what I do know for a fact. It will be a body that glorifies him. And when it glorifies God, it will fulfill the person who got it. And it will do this forever and forever and forever. No wrinkles to change it forever. And all the beauty and prestige and honor attributed here to anyone for their body's sake is but a flower that fades. Here they bloom, but for a season. Soon their beauty is decayed, but not where we are going. And then we saw that there are two realities. There is the physical, but there is the spiritual, the unseen realm. Oh, it is so easy in life to forget about this spiritual side, even to forget about the battle we're in. And without knowing it, we're listening to somebody we ought not to be listening to. Well, may the Lord bless the thought of the resurrection to us this resurrection day.